Good evening. We are here for day four of this little adventure, and we have a pretty full list of departments this evening. The DA, the Sheriff's Office, Human Service Coalition, community agencies, HSC, straight up, OAR, Health Department, and Cooperative Extension. And we will begin with the District Attorney. Welcome.
Good evening, everybody.
Ms. Wilkinson. Good evening.
And welcome to my ninth budget presentation. And like the eight previous ones, this one's not going to be much more interesting or surprising. Luckily, I have a technical assistant here who's going to help me navigate through this PowerPoint.
Gwen, may I just say something? This is in Chapter 4, page 100, OTRs 12, 13, and 14. And go ahead.
Thank you. All right. Now I have two microphones and my technical assistant. You were just showing me how to do this. Oh, just that? Okay. No laughing. All right. This is pretty straightforward. I think this is the slide that tells you that we're staying in whatever target range we needed to stay in so that we stay out of trouble with the governor. More on that later. The next slide is major influences. This really goes to my OTR, which is unsupported this year, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. You've heard me say this before. We've been doing more with less for many years now, and the time is coming where it is not going to be possible to maintain the kind of effort that we've managed to maintain for the last 9 years. The things that are going to happen in the coming year is that are the things that I put on this slide. We have moved from 1.5 to 2 full-time city court judges, and they are proposing significant increases in court sessions, which just by virtue of time allocation is going to increase our resources for city court by up to 25%, just based on the numbers. And as you're probably aware, Chief Judge Lippman of the Court of Appeals, the Chief Judge of the State of New York, enforced a rule that defense counsel be present at first arraignments for every single case. And that means disorderly conduct, it means harassment, it means misdemeanors, felonies, everything. Local court justices have to call defense attorneys for people who qualify for assigned counsel. This is not a new law. Defendants have always been entitled to counsel at all critical stages of a case, and an arraignment is a critical stage of the case, and Judge Lippman has ruled that this is going to be attended by defense attorneys at every single one. That's a good thing, but we don't have the resources to cover all arraignments. We lack personnel to cover after-hour arraignments. We lack personnel to cover unanticipated arraignments that come up kind of suddenly during the day when somebody's picked up on a warrant. In the past, it didn't matter so much because neither side had representation at arraignment. But now, of course, it is going to matter. I am trying to analyze exactly what that's coming down to in terms of hours, person hours, but expect to be hearing from me on that in the future, because at this point we are literally not covering out of our arraignments unless the courts call us on the phone. And finally, pending legislation. This is legislation that is being proposed by people who share a belief that prosecutors are taking advantage of the current discovery laws to hide evidence, to not turn over documents that would help defense attorneys represent their clients. There's legislation pending from Senator Savino's office. It went to codes in January of 2014 for the second time. the Justice Task Force, which is a body convened by Judge Lipman, which has done a lot of good things, is now proposing some very, very radical and far-reaching changes to the criminal procedure law regarding criminal discovery. If passed, and I think it will pass in some form, it is going to vastly increase the amount of time and the number of people that are going to have to deal with criminal discovery, because it will be in every single case, not just the cases where a plea offer is rejected. It will be in every single case, and it will not just deal with exculpatory evidence. The prosecution may actually be required to investigate what is essentially the defense case. If it happens, it happens, and we'll deal with it. I think there's a good chance it will happen in 2015. When it does, that will bring us to a screeching halt, and I will be back in front of you on an emergency basis saying we need more admin, we need another lawyer. That'll just be the name of that game at that point. We're not there yet. I'm just telling you, I think it's coming. Moving on to full-time equivalents, we're down a little what we've lost. We lost 0.05 of the victim advocate recovery specialist. So in 2015, that's zeroed out. Looks like everything else has remained the same, moving us down in 2014 from 1225 to the 2015 number I show of 12.20 FTE. So I show us down from last year. Technical person, what does that say? Yeah, we're not. We're down.
We should work together.
We should. All right. And I apologize. I've been kind of busy with crime. Kevin and I didn't get to touch base about this before I came here tonight. There's going to be another thing that I'm going to have to tell you about here that is different than what it's going to appear on the slides. And it's simply a matter of there not being enough hours in the day. But we're actually, I show us being down 0.05 FTE. Okay. Now, the over-target request supported by the budget, this is pretty straightforward. If you remember, I think $182,500 was set aside for to get the new case management software, which we are well in the process of transitioning into. We're getting the licenses purchased. We're getting Wi-Fi connections. We've got tablets. We've got scanners. But it turns out there's an annual support fee for the case management software system, which seems kind of fair. We actually got the actual product for nothing through the New York Prosecutors Training Institute, so we did a good job of shopping for that. This is an OTR because we didn't budget it in anywhere, but it just goes to pay for the case management software system that you all approved. Actually, I think two budgets ago is when it was first approved to bring us into the 20th century with our ability to break out information and data from our database so that when you guys ask me questions like, well, how many DWI felonies did you have in March, I'll actually be able to tell you. And we'll be able to keep track of a lot of other important information, too, that Public Safety Committee will probably find useful. So that's what that is, and it's supported, so we'll leave that behind. Now we come to the over-target request not supported. And I'm not – I understand that we can't support the addition of the new lawyer this year. I asked because we need it, and I need you to know that we need it. I understand that we don't have the money. I understand that we have to deal with the governor's restrictions on what happens if we don't bring our budget in the parameters that he wants us to. This is not a do-or-die request this year. Next year it probably will be, so we have to think in those terms. As for the over-target request in the amount of $20,481 to pay for professional services related to preparing and trying cases, we still have sound, yeah. Of that sum, $5,550 is needed to pay for the grand jury stenographer contract. When we broke out our budget lines, I'm sure it was my error, we contract with Susan Nicholas Miller to be the stenographer in the grand jury, and we're mandated by law to have a grand jury, and we're mandated by law to have a stenographer in the grand jury, and she is the best deal for the money, but her contract is approximately, I think it might be $18,000 even. And in that line, we've only left about $14,000 in change. When I noticed this error, I sent Joe an email, but it was only like 24 hours ago. So of that $20,481, I can't pay for the grand jury stenographer unless I can get $5,500 of it back. So I suppose for the sake of this presentation, pretend that over-target request says $5,550, and pretend Joe says that he's thinking seriously about supporting it, because I think he is.
Okay.
All right.
Some lawyer talk.
We're good at pretending.
Yes. All right. That brings me to the end of the presentation, and I will take questions from
Mike Ziegler, I see your hand. Go ahead.
I just had two questions. So the that annual support, I mean, that's going to go on forever, right?
Correct.
Okay. And my other question is, and this is something I should know, but we are your only budgeting source. So you don't get, like, when you go and do a case in the city doesn't pay a fee for...
No, that's correct. To be totally comprehensively and relentlessly informative about it, I could, as a special prosecutor, demand a fee from counties where I do special prosecutor work, because I do. But I need them to do special prosecutor work for me from time to time. And we all sort of have a civilized agreement that we don't charge each other. The only funding source I get other than local tax dollars is I get state aid for my salary in the amount of $67,171, and I get DCJS aid to prosecution money in the amount of $29,200, which pays part of the salary of one of the ADAs who prosecutes serious violent repeat offenders. Okay?
Anyone else? Mike Lyon.
Hi, Gwen. Two things. One is on the second over-target request for the ADA. Are you thinking that you need to have a full-time person, or can you go to, say, two part-time people, or maybe one part-time person first? Or
I think since this is just the shot across the bow, let's wait and see if that legislation gets passed. If Savino's bill is passed to amend the criminal discovery law, I think we're going to need a whole attorney and an admin or two. If it doesn't, and we're dealing with just the 24-hour coverage for arraignment, I think we could go to a part-time person.
And that brings up, I guess, the third question. I'll come back to the second one. But
okay.
Is there pushback from the DA's Association and others
Major.
About this?
Major.
Is it something that we should be looking at a county level to talk about at the NYSAC or other places?
Well, that's an interesting thought. Yeah, why don't we, in maybe the Public Safety Committee and with you, of course, I could share with you some of the correspondence, some of the thoughts that have gone back and forth. This has been going on for about a year. I've been in touch with Frank Sedita. He and I have been corresponding pretty regularly on what looks like the verge of some pretty momentous changes. And I need all the help I can get. So do all of us who believe that these laws are not going to achieve their stated purpose, which is to reduce wrongful convictions.
Right. And that, I mean, if I understand that's the position. I don't know them well enough to be able to make a comment. But I would think that if this is as important a change as you're talking about, that it would do well to inform the county legislature and, and to look at this.
I'd be happy to. We can make a date.
Legislation that we should comment on at some point.
Yeah, it will change criminal prosecution as we know it. Some of the changes are good, actually, frankly. Some are not. Some are really not. So I'd be happy to discuss scheduling a time for me to report out to whatever group you want.
Well, I think we could probably start at Brian's committee.
Okay. All right.
And the other question two.
Question two, yeah.
Do you expect there to be, I mean, you'd like there to be a an ADA at the arraignment if there's going to be a defense counsel there. Do you expect to have a lot of different outcomes at the first arraignment if an ADA isn't there? Do you expect them to be, I don't know, more people released or more people not bailed or
yes,
what?
Yes, I do.
Can you explain what you think would happen?
Sure. I think, and I've spoken to some of the justices who do the arraigning. It's not usually the county court that does that. And they say that they find having the defense attorney there at first arraignment results in more people being released on their own recognizance or having lower bail set. Now, I don't have a problem with either the concept of ROR or the concept of a judiciously determined bail based on the factors in the law. But once you have one side in the courtroom, you really need the other side in the courtroom or things will get one-sided. And there are people who need bail, and I think I'm the only one. My office is the only one that can argue for it at arraignment. We're the only one that can say to the judge, well, judge, he's bench warranted five times. That clearly shows he's not going to return to court willingly, and we need some bail to secure his return. The defense attorney's certainly not going to tell the court that.
Someone had their hand up over here. Dooley, and then Peter, and then Carol. Go ahead.
In your department, what does premium pay cover?
What does what?
Premium pay.
I have no idea. Where are you saying that?
I'm on page 102. It's
the okay.
What was the explanation the other night?
Oh. Hang on, Julie. We're getting it.
Gwen, this is something I'm asking each department because it means different things, different places. Or it may mean different things.
Okay. Do I not have that page?
Is that a get back to your question, Kevin?
I believe, as in many of the cases that you've asked about, Dooley, I believe it's longevity payment.
That's all.
I don't know what else it could be. It's okay. Not shift pay. It's not any of those other pays, so it's got to be longevity.
Yes. In the $3,000 of target in their budget line is completely accounted for by a $3,000 budget for longevity.
Thank you. On the same page, 102, the professional services goes way down.
Yeah.
That's... It must be the stenographer, one stenographer you were talking about, but what else?
Well, professional services is accident reconstructionists, private lab tests where we have some forensic evidence that is beyond the capabilities of the state police lab, things we have to pay for. It could be in the unfortunate dog cruelty case that we just got today, it will be the veterinarian. It will be boarding that dog. It might be an expert to testify about a psychiatric defense, to rebut a psychiatric defense. So the reason the number went way down is that's the only place we could cut. And, you know, as I've said before, I mean, it's the only place there's any fat. And as I've said before, if expenses crop up in the course of a prosecution of a serious case, I have to make the decision whether or not to incur them. And as I've said to you all before, I don't let money drive the bus, but sometimes I let it steer. And I do that, and I will continue to do that. But I can come to the general fund with a supplemental appropriation request, as I did all throughout the Corbin White matters, and that... we can anticipate that again with this number being as low as it is now. But that's what that's about.
So we are forewarned. Thank you.
Yes, you are.
Peter Stein.
If the answer to this is very long, then forget about it. But
you're giving me an out, you know.
Can you quickly sort of tell us a few of the things that you, the most important things that you support and the ones that you don't support in this list of changes that you're talking about?
Oh, yes. Do you mean the criminal discovery law?
Yeah.
I fiercely oppose the requirement that prosecutors determine what is relevant to the defense. We're going to be asked to turn over any information, whether possessed by the police or a civilian, that is relevant to the defense. Not exculpatory, not impeachment, relevant. I oppose that. I think it's impossible to do because you do it. The analysis is always done in hindsight after the case is over. I am violently opposed, and in fact, we won't go that far. I'm violently opposed to turning over the names, addresses, and contact information for civilian witnesses for the prosecution. It's bad enough that we have to turn them over a couple days before trial. We may be asked to turn them over a month before trial. We may be asked to turn them over a month after initial arraignment. I think that's a bad idea. It won't stop wrongful convictions. It will enhance wrongful acquittals. We've already seen in our county court, we've seen victims get on the witness stand and lie when they walk into that room. We know what their story is, and they look at that defendant, and they tell a different story, and they come out, and they say, I'm sorry. I'm too scared. He'll kill me. In Ithaca, New York, it's happening. We've seen it happen in two or three cases that I know about now. So I'm opposed to that. And then the other things are more picayune and more legally technical, and we can take those up at another time. But protection of witnesses, and we should not be obligated to build the defense case for the defense. That goes beyond what the Constitution requires.
I find that a little bit surprising. I mean, if you have something that's exculpatory, you just say you don't have any obligation to turn that over?
Oh, no, absolutely. Under Brady v. Maryland, Supreme Court case, if I have something that indicates that defendant didn't commit that crime, I turn it over immediately. Immediately. If I have impeachment evidence that goes to the credibility of one of my witnesses, I have to turn that over in time for it to be made, for effective use to be made of it. But how the heck am I supposed to figure out in real time, as a criminal case unfolds, what might possibly be relevant, whether or not I intend to use it at trial? So more to come on that.
Okay.
But
interesting.
Yeah,
thanks.
That's the nutshell.
Carol Chuck.
I don't know if this is so much a question for Gwen. Other than in terms of what the expenses will be. If memory serves correctly, I think we heard recently, now the element of the Savino bill that is, that would require you to have another attorney, the showing up at arraignment, I think that we heard recently from people involved in alternatives to incarceration that that is something that might lower our costs, jail costs. So I think if we're going to talk about that, I'm going to request that
we are not.
People get together. Is that what we were referring to, Brian's?
We are not going to talk about it this evening.
At the budget meeting, because I understand that.
No, we are not. Go ahead,
can
Brian.
Can I finish your thought?
Can I finish my sentence, please?
If it's a question.
Yeah, so I just would ask that when that come to committee, that somebody or different from different perspectives, that we end up with something that we've called a life cycle analysis in other fields that looks at the costs and the benefits to our system on that one.
Just to there was a question in there, I think, if the part of Senator Savino's bill that, et cetera, requires defense. That's not part of the bill. That's required now.
Right.
Jonathan Lippman, Judge Lippman, made that a requirement now. It is happening now.
Brian.
Okay.
And maybe to just kind of answer Carol's question a little bit, that cost savings is actually covered in the next presentation with the sheriff's office as far as any sort of savings related to the jail, whether it be from counsel at first arraignment or the addition of more beds or whatever. That, there's actually a kind of a negative OTR in there is how it appeared to me.
Yeah. So it's just but the, like but there's the impact on other offices, so we should look at it as a system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. It's all part of the puzzle, eventually.
Anyone else? Thank you, Gwen.
Thank you.
Next up is the sheriff, and it is Chapter 4, page 297. He has one OTR, and it was put into the county administrator's budget.
Hi, Ashley. Good. Would you like a copy? Down there, okay? Well, that's the
same. No, it ain't that. That's the one's going to take me to the next level. Huh? Yeah, all right. Thank you for that.
Are we all set, Mr. Dennis?
Yeah, you're on. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Before I start the presentation, I know the DA referred to the situations, obviously, that we're all aware of, but nonetheless, I feel I have to speak to it also. You know, we have been, during my term, keeping an eye on expenditures, doing our best to cut budgets and save money where we can. As we looked at this budget and what we were requested to do, I'm going to tell you that it was very, very difficult, and I'm truly scared that, you know, how much more can we go. And I'm not sure what next year is going to bring, but we did know over targets this time, but I can't believe I won't have to come to you next year. So let's all hope that the economical situations get better, I guess. But I won't dwell on a lot of that. We all know costs have gone up in every aspect of our law enforcement procedures and your homes, gas, food, clothing, whatever. As you can see here, our budget's in front of you now. We cut the 1%, as you can see, the $60,000 there. We'll show you now where some of this came from. Personnel cost, fleet maintenance, and fuel cost, they're obviously a concern for us, especially fleet maintenance. We just can't keep up with the car if we're not buying more new cars. It's very expensive to repair the old ones. And fuel costs, as we all know, are coming down right now, but tomorrow they could go right back up. We've requested no increase in personnel. We still stay status quo. It would be nice if we could get more, but we know that that's not even something I'm going to ask for. No arbor target requests, as I stated earlier. And now we'll go to the jail budget. As you can see, looking at the jail budget, where you're attempting to stay status quo in many instances. As Brian alluded to, possibly for Carol's question, you'll see later on in this presentation where possible monies may help other agencies within the county. The effects on the 2015 budget that have created a difference, personnel costs and additional projects in the jail that require additional manpower, the ATT tower project, the Verizon tower project, the heat pump installation, the rewiring of the jail. We've had a lot of extra projects going on right now up at our facility, and when someone comes into our facility and has to be on the correction side, either outside in the yard or inside the facility, we have to at all times have them have a corrections officer with them. It's mandated by the state, and it only makes sense, obviously. But so some costs there. Fuel costs, again, that's going to continue to keep coming up wherever we talk. This is the vehicle replacement. I spoke to that already. It affects all parts of the road and the jail. Board out and medical costs. They're not coming down, but hopefully the board out we'll see. I hope by at least the end of 2015. All right, again, status quo inside with the numbers of people. Right here, you can see where we're hoping to take $58,000 in an attempted board out cost to support the OTR for the new OAR client service worker. And let's hope that comes through, and I'm sure that we're going to do our best to accomplish that for you. I promise, Deb. Okay. That's pretty much it. I'm sure you have questions for me. And I hope that I can answer those to the best of my ability.
Question for the sheriff and Joe.
Well, I just want to, on the OTR, I want to make it clear that that was initiated by my office. We had originally, if you recall back in April, we had looked at the trend line of board outs and also medical expenses. We'd seen that going up a lot. And we built the budget based on that. It was after talking to the sheriff, looking at the seven beds, looking at what we proposed for OAR in the form of an OTR, and as you said earlier, looking at the early effects of the Council of First Appearance, we felt comfortable enough that we could reduce that. We took it down by an average of 2 inmates per day, so that was the reduction in the board out amount, and that equates to $58,000 worth of savings. In building that savings in, it really then gave us the capacity to do the OAR over target request without having an effect on the county's bottom line. We felt that was an appropriate and prudent thing to do. So that's the OTR that you see in the sheriff's budget.
And as the DA stated, I know that it's difficult on her office, but it does appear already in the early stages of the arraignments that we are seeing a cost-effective thing inside the jail by people not being sent to jail at the arraignment time. And that's a very positive thing for everybody.
Peter Stein. Peter Stein.
Thank you. Something I never heard of before, but in recent past I've been reading it in national newspapers and reading in the Ithaca Journal regarding the IPD, is this notion of having all of the policemen or deputies wearing cameras that kept a copy of their activities to reassure the public that the kinds of things that many people are concerned about of wrong behavior by deputies is not true. Have you thought about that for the sheriff's deputies, and have you got any idea as to what the cost would be to have the whole department have those?
Yes, Peter. I've given careful thought to that even before these incidents took place. A good friend of mine, Sheriff Yesman in Schuyler County, who I've known forever, he has cameras on his canine, and now I see that a lot of the road deputies also have those the cameras. I support it. We are looking at various different cameras that we can go with. Some have lower prices for the camera itself, but a very high maintenance cost with the company to maintain it and to keep the records. Sheriff Yesman right now, his cameras that he uses and that he's very happy with, the initial cost of the camera is a little higher, but the maintaining of the records and everything, there is no extra cost. So I'm getting more information on that. And I agree with it. I noticed this year while over at Watkins Glen, we had an incident over there, and obviously everybody that was there, there was two people, individuals that stood out with their phones, you know, taking and filming. Well, I feel that it's only fair that we all film, you know, and it surely can do exactly what you hope, Peter, and I also hope that it also can help the men and women out there to show that they acted in an appropriate manner and so on. So it has worked for Sheriff Yesman and other sheriffs that have incorporated this, and I look forward to bringing that to our department in 2015.
So the cost is not prohibitive, is that right? Okay, that's good news.
Sheriff, are there grants available maybe through Homeland since they give us money for other things that sometimes aren't the best things to have, but are there grants for that?
Yeah, I believe so, Jim. Also, I was approached, I don't know how many months ago, but it was quite a few months ago, by one of the organizations here asking me if I was in favor of that. I responded to them and said I was. I just needed to find the monies to make it work, and I kind of got an idea that they might be willing to help. But, yes, there are different foundations and stuff that I plan on going to once I determine which ones we need or should have for the officers to wear.
Mike Sigler.
A little more for Joe. The $58,000 in here for the savings, the anticipated savings, I mean, that's not all of that anticipated savings. Have we plugged in anticipated savings from the board outs because of the jail expansion other places already or no?
No. I mean, we're being pretty conservative. So we're assuming if we're going to go from 8 on average last year to 6 on average next year. So we've taken a two-person reduction, and that's a $58,000 savings. So that's the only savings that has been taken in this budget.
And that's the only savings you think we're going to realize, or do you think there's going to be more on top of that?
I'm hoping there's going to be more. I think we're best to be cautious about what we project.
Oh, well, that's fine. I just was wondering if Ben was in here talking about
that's
other
it.
Things.
Yeah.
All right, next.
Brian, and then Dooley.
Maybe just to expound upon that a little bit. First off, you got to remember that construction is going to be in 2015, so you're really not going to realize any savings. And the hope is that there is additional savings, and I would guess, I'm not going to speak for Joe, but I would guess that a lot of that savings would go towards the debt service for the project, if not in part, wholly. That was the idea to begin with, and that's what we would expect from the numbers.
Dooley.
Thank you. I'm looking at page 299, which is entitled Sheriff's Office Civil. And if I'm reading it correctly, it looks as though the salary and wages go up from 2014 to 2015, but the fringe benefits go down. And I wonder how that happened.
I can answer that.
All right, Joe. Thank you.
Fringes are generally they're down a little bit from the year before, largely because of the pension reduction, the pension rates going from 20% down to 18%. So when you look at things that are flat, the pension, the fringe rate should be going down a little bit.
Oh, I've looked at many of those lines elsewhere in the budget and haven't been noticing that. But I noticed it here. So.
Yeah.
I have another question. I'm looking at page 305, which is Sheriff's Office, Jail, Medical, and Boarding. And I wonder if you have available the a breakdown which would separate the medical costs each day for each board out from the board out cost. I don't need it tonight, but I would like to see that.
Okay.
You get that.
Okay.
We will try to get that.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Mike Lyon, Carol Chalk.
Ken, I was looking at your overtime budget on page 297, and for some reason it went up quite a bit last year, and I imagine that things got moved around. Went from, according to line 2, 116,493 to 341,223, and we're looking at that for Target again this year. Are we using more overtime? And I wondered, in relation to that, I know at one point you talked about exploring using some part-time officers to fill in for overtime and maybe transport or other things.
Right.
Wondered how that's going.
We surely hit a brick wall with the correction side as far as part-timers are concerned. They're not interested at all at this point in time during our negotiations. We have not settled a roadside negotiation, but I'm also presenting that to them, part-timers. They could help the department completely, both sides. So that's where that stands. The overtime, yes, we've had some overtime increases, obviously, as I stated earlier, especially in the corrections side, not just because of people being on disability and stuff, but the projects that we've had to bring in. Most of those projects will be offset by monies that will be realized from the companies. We do charge them for the overtime where we had to put the extra corrections officers in there to be with their people while they're working, so we will be reimbursed for that overtime, Mike. Also, I think if this is a question that comes up every year, I think if that's what you're referring to possibly, this shows it calculated time and a half, and which we all know overtime is, but what happens here with that figure, it changes because we bring in the salary to it and it cuts it back somehow. It's always confusing. It's confusing to me to explain, but it comes up, I think, every year.
This is the 0.5, right? Joe, I think you
told us that. I'm sorry, I was looking at something else. But if you're comparing the actual expenditure of 2013 to the budgeted expenditure for 2015, it is that 0.5 versus 1.5. So when we budget that full 1.5 times salary equals overtime. When the accountants get it, the 0.5 goes into the overtime account. The 1 goes into the salary and wage account, which makes it very difficult to compare those overtime lines over time. As I think I said before, if you take 3 times what you see in the actual and compare that against the budget, it gives you a pretty good idea of kind of how those overtime amounts fare from year to year.
Thank you.
Ken, if I could follow up on the part-time thing again.
Sure.
And you said you hit a brick wall, obviously, in your negotiations.
Right.
Can you give me a flavor of what the other side are objecting to with that?
As far as the roadside?
You said corrections. You ran into a brick wall.
Right, exactly.
I don't want to get into your negotiations.
No, that's fine.
But I kind of wonder what kind of thinking is there that they would be opposed to that?
Well, the thinking... whenever you talk part-time, the thinking that the full-timers always have, it's going to take away our overtime, okay? Well, there are many ways to negotiate that, and we did it in Cougar Heights, okay? And it worked very well, and full-timers, once they get a taste of part-timers, really like it, and they realize it really doesn't take their overtime away if the way it's proposed, and I'll tell you, Mike, we tried many different things. I listened to what they had to say and compensated for that and really thought that we brought a great proposal forward to get part-timers that would answer, I thought, their questions about worrying about overtime and stuff. And I just think there's enough old salts in there that just aren't ready to give it up. I think the younger ones would appreciate it. Just not that, I know you don't want to talk about negotiations, but... and I don't too much either, but just to give you a flavor for the negotiations, sometimes we wanted to mandate that people that are on their days off couldn't be forced in for overtime. They didn't even want that. That was very concerning to me, okay? So just to give you an idea, getting away from the overtime is just, I don't know what you want to call it, but attitude, whatever, or perception, I'm not sure.
So it's
very difficult.
It just sounds to me, and if I'm right, that... there's sort of a feeling of entitlement to overtime?
I say that word so many times I get tired of saying it, but there's a lot of entitlement going on in this world today, and I just shake my head, yes. I mean, that's what it is. And I think there's hope down the road, and when I say that, I'm really referring also to the road patrol. I think they would accept that. And if that happens, there's things that we might be able to do that I can use those people for on the correction side.
Thank you, Ken. I didn't want to dwell on it too long, but I really think it's important that this legislature understand that issue because It's something that could potentially save us some overtime costs, which by also employing some people that might like some part-time work.
Yeah, and it works like that. You're right, Michael. It also sometimes you can get people in that are, you know, wanting to become corrections officers or road patrol, whatever, and you get a chance to see them, okay? You actually get to see them and what they're able and capable to do. And like I say, my experience with part-time, I did it for 25 years myself as a police officer. I worked in Dryden, as you know. I worked in Truensburg part-time. It was great for me. I worked in Schuyler County. But when the full-timers understand, boy, this really isn't hurting us, but it sure does help me when I want a day off or I want to, you know, that nobody else can work for me, it works great. And I'm just hoping that we can convince them of that during negotiations because we work at it very hard, and I bring it up every time.
Thank you.
No. Carol Chalk and then Brian.
This question is for Joe, really. I'm just trying to make sure that I understand completely the way you've listed the $58,000 in our, you know, our listing, various listings that we've got of the over-target requests is as a negative request. And I just put that in context for us as you worked with this and other departments. There are things, you know, where you worked with departments where their requests or their budgets, you know, you were not funding items before it got into here. So what was it about this one that you chose to call it out, or can you contrast
it?
Or
it's a weird item because you make a good point. These are called over target requests, and I'm bringing it down below kind of what the target was, what the expectation was. This is almost like a mandated cost, so we adjusted that cost up early in the budget process because our expectation was that our numbers would look like they have in the recent past. So that number was set at a certain level, as was everything else. So then as we're looking at the budget and trying to figure out how to basically approach it and how to balance things out, in looking at OAR's request for an additional staff person and believing that that will contribute to reduce board outs and looking at the seven beds that have been added, all those other things basically gave us confidence to be able to reduce that initial estimate by $58,000. We probably could have just done that internally, but we felt it was important to call it out and bring it to the legislature's attention of what we were doing and how we were balancing out that new cost. So, again, you're right. It's a bit unconventional because it's not over a target. If anything, it's under a target. And by achieving that savings, it allowed us to pay for another over-target request.
Yeah, no, I'm understanding what the $58,000 is. I'm not sure I think it's a high enough number. I was hoping for a higher number or that once we really have the changes made that it will be a higher negative number, but I'm asking, are there places that something like that in another department wouldn't even show up in our budget? You know, where a department is going to not do something it was doing before.
Yeah, and stay within its target. Yeah, it's possible, Carol. And again, this is kind of an unusual thing. I wanted to call it out. There's some things that we do because the legislature would otherwise may not see it. So, again, we could have just dropped our initial estimate of this, but instead chose to do this under-target request.
Brian.
Thanks. And, yes, that is unusual, but almost necessary because the whole jail reconfiguration issue was designed to reduce costs. You're going to get asked about that, and this is simply just an illustration to show that going towards basically a recommendation from the task force, which also came out of that issue. My question was for overtime, because there's been a lot of discussion about that, and I guess this would fall under the no good deed goes unpunished category. You have counsel at first arraignment, which is a great idea. It basically takes out a step, is what it amounts to. But that in and of itself creates overtime, because now instead of going before a local criminal court, with a defendant and an officer. Now you have to wait for an attorney to get there. They're generally not up and dressed at 2 in the morning. So it does. It's a give and take. It does create costs. So I just wanted to point that out in the event that it plays out where overtime costs for 2015 are slightly up. That's a reason why. And I have to form this in the as a question. So, right?
Is that you asking me?
I got to ask someone.
Yes, and you're right, Brian. And of course, as you well know, having been in the business, it all matters what time that arrest takes place. If it takes place early enough. But the other thing, just not only just the overtime, and it reminds me today because of an email I got from a citizen here in the community worried about the response time while his truck was being broken into and his wife had to look out the window, he and she they watched the truck being broken into because we couldn't get a car there quick enough to assist. The biggest problem, the overtime is a concern, but I want you to realize that takes one of our cars, which we may only have three out there, off the road also for a considerable amount of time. And that's what we're finding is happening. And like I say, today I got an email from a concerned citizen, and we answered it, and he was grateful for how we answered it for him. But we're not grateful because we wish we could have got their car there a little bit quicker, that's for sure. So there's several little things that go on, and hopefully it'll all iron out and be an even give and take, I hope, so in the future.
Anyone else? Thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you.
I have Human Service Coalition, Community Agencies, Chapter 5, page 26, and they have OTRs number 21 through 28. And eight of them were asked for. Four are funded in the administrator's budget, and one partially, three not.
Good evening. Okay, we're going to start with the community agencies. I did want you to, well, oops.
What is it? My mic?
Okay, I think probably on your spots, we handed out two documents. One was our spreadsheet, our funding spreadsheet, and the second one was we asked the agencies to give us some of the influences they were seeing on their service delivery. And so there's a sheet, has each agency we represent. This is a very short definition of them and what they said. So I've summarized it later on in the slides. So first thing we want to talk about every year, we give you the list of the people who sat on our Citizens Review Committee to review the applications that we got in. As you can see, it's Gladys Brangman, Diane Cohen from Finger Lakes Reuse, Mary Pat Dolan, I think everybody knows, Sue Cattell, John Lemley, and Ron Provost. It was a good group. Some of them have, I think there's only one person that this was their first year, Diane. So, recommended budget. I have nothing to say about that slide except there it is. If you have any questions, you've got Kevin, you've got Joe. Major influences that kind of summarize what that two-page document is, what we heard from agencies is there is a need for more intensive case management. They're seeing people come in who can't just be told where to go, can't just be referred someplace, really need help connecting people, then they have to go back to and say, were you able to get that service? Maybe go back to 4 months. Are you still able to maintain your housing?
So for agencies that just have somebody that does intake and maybe a quick referral, they're feeling that they to really help people become more stable, they're going to need a little more in-depth services. The lack of safe, affordable housing. This is always an issue. Not every agency obviously deals with housing, but every agency is impacted. Their clients are impacted by how hard it is to find safe, affordable housing in this community. It affects every kind of aspect. It affects people's health, their ability to get to work, their ability to find daycare, their support system. Their children, which schools they go to, the ability for the children to succeed in school. So stable housing is just kind of more than one agency mentioned how that is a real issue they deal with all the time. And it's also very expensive. It's expensive for the people who are constantly switching housing, always need security deposits, first and last month's rent, but that also becomes expensive for the community. Jobs, which is also having the jobs for people and the programs that can give people the skills and the training they need to get and stay in those jobs. And it's not just you're trained, you've got the job, now we can step back and leave. I mean, there has to be support for people and jobs to help them to be successful. Shrinking resources as the demand for services go. Federal and state funding and a lot of programs is shifting for reasons that I don't know that anybody knows. Things like, I know Diane Dawson's here, some of her federal funding is shrinking while, as everybody knows, the aging population is growing. Clients presented with multiple issues and fewer resources. Multiple issues, both physical and emotional resources to rely on. People are seeing more mental health needs, fewer housing options, addictions, unemployment. So helping clients with multiple issues takes a lot more time, which means more staffing. Over target requests. These are the ones that are supported. Advocacy centers. The first one, they lost some state funding. With state funding, and they requested $2,000 to help. That won't cover all they lost, but to help a little bit with that. Lifelong funding. They had lost some funding last year's budget, and they requested that be restored. And this restores their funding to the 2013 level. One of the things we look at when we look at all the agencies is their staffing patterns and their compensation patterns. And some agencies are able to do better than others, so we try to help the ones that are struggling a little bit. And so the $2,500 for Southside was to help stabilize their staffing, increase wages a bit. And Tompkins Learning Partners. They had started this basic computer education class in Dryden, which was very successful, and they wanted to take it on the road, so to speak, increase that to other rural areas, and they asked for $5,000 in one-time money to be able to take that program out in 2015. Those were all recommended. Partially supported, Multicultural Resource Center. I guess everybody probably knows that Audrey Cooper is retiring at the end of this year. And Multicultural requested $10,000 in one-time funding to help transition. They have like 1.5 staff. So to transition the new director and to help tie up some ongoing projects. And the recommendation was for $3,000. There you go. And the requests that were not funded. Catholic Charities requested $7,500 for one of, they were going to combine it with other funding they had to put on a part-time person to do the kind of case management that I was referring to. People who come to the Samaritan Center that need more help than their one staff person has time to give them. So they requested $7,500, which the review committee recommended and was not recommended by the county administrator. The 48.23 requested as target. The Downtown Ithaca Children's Center is another agency that has worked really hard to help get the compensation level up for their staff, but it is still below the normal and below the living wage. So they're doing a lot better with the benefits they're providing to staff, but salaries are still fairly low. And Food Distribution Network, we asked for $5,000 in one-time funding. There are some cuts to food stamps. Why people would cut food stamps is beyond me, but that is one of the things. And, you know, we keep hearing from the food pantries that more people are coming. So we asked for $5,000 there. Oops. I'll go back. Any questions?
Yes, Peter Stein. Go ahead, Peter, and then Dooley.
I'd like to ask the county administrator why he didn't fund the last one. I can't imagine anything more fundamental than being able to distribute food to hungry people.
I think you see, I hope you see, Peter, a pattern in what we funded here. And first of all, you know, for perspective, we did provided 10% plus increase for the agencies. So it began with a 1% increase that went across the board to all agencies. By the time the OTRs were funded, we lifted the agencies by over 10%. So I think that's an important part of the context. There came a point when the resources just basically ran out. We didn't have enough money to do all the OTRs that were here. I think the pattern that you'll see among the agencies is we tried to sustain things that were already in progress. We tried to maintain things that were being done already. There's an exception or two from that. We thought there were compelling reasons why we should add a little bit more. But overall, it's to maintain current levels of effort. This was an add-on. So this was an increase above what we already provide to the Food Distribution Network for this program. I think you see the same thing in the other two OTRs up there that weren't approved, the addition of a part-time person and the staff compensation within the Children's Center.
Thank you.
Dooley.
Thank you. Looking at the pages in the budget book that list your OTRs and their priorities from your perspective, there is no priority three. What was it?
What were my priorities?
No, there. It goes from 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, and so on. There is no third priority, and I wondered what had been there and was taken out, if anything.
Yeah, I can speak to that. There were changes along the way, so there was an OTR that was withdrawn. It was in there. That was probably number three. We probably never renumbered those OTRs. So it was simply.
Do you know what it was?
We during the process, we found out that we got some more city funding. Sales tax funding, so we were able to cover one or two of them with our increase in city funding. Right off the bat, I can't remember. One was a little extra money for Tompkins Learning Partners to bring their salaries up to living wage, and what was the second one? Oh.
Yeah,
and lifelong, part of lifelong.
Right, we took some of the money, and so the request you saw from lifelong was for more money than you see. So we took some of the city sales tax and filled it, and what you see is what was left that we couldn't cover from the city sales tax. So I think it was $8,000.
And if I can just add something here, it's important for the legislature to know. I don't think these priorities were as assigned by you. I don't think the consortium assigned priorities. So these are basically in the order received. So don't read number six as the...
We never put priorities because we don't really pick one agency over another as a priority. We just send them all in.
I'm glad you said that because we ask for things in priority order. So when it doesn't mean that, it would be good to just say that.
Yes, I'm sorry. We have always been non-compliant in that.
I'm looking at page 5-27, which is the program called Basic Subsistence, and I have no idea what's included in that. Could you describe that, please?
Do you want,
Kevin.
That's essentially our accounting basket for all of the agencies that they are our intermediary with the exception of, as you can see, OAR has its own. So the basic subsistence and OAR are the two components of the community agencies portion of our fiscal relationship with the Human Services Coalition.
That's interesting. Thank you.
I had Peter and then Carol.
Just a thought that occurred to me when I was listening to your presentation. You talked about the need for affordable housing, and everybody talks about the need for affordable housing. And it occurred to me sometimes that we have a semi-infinite demand for affordable housing when I drive the wrong way and find all that traffic coming in from outside the county. And I wondered, when you have a few people in need, how do you reserve the affordable housing for our own residents that are desperately in need to affordable housing for people from the outside who want to come in because they'd rather live here than where they are living at the moment? Is there any way of prioritizing it? Does it make sense for the Human Services Coalition to have a relatively small group of affordable housing that's reserved for their clients? Just as a thought I had.
When new housing projects are built, if they get certain, you know, federal funds, they have to set up. I mean, they all have income qualifications, but some of them have to be set aside for certain populations. I don't know the answer about whether they can restrict them to people who live in this county or not. I think that's what you're asking. I actually don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think one of the big problems in this county is the rents are just so high compared to the subsidies that people can, you know, receive for housing. So being able to find housing for the amounts of money that people get is safe housing is really very difficult. I mean, people have vouchers that just they can't find any place to rent. Even if they have Section 8 vouchers, they won't. They can't find any place to rent. So it's, I mean, you know, everybody knows it's a real struggle in Tompkins County to find housing. But that not having stable housing can just affect everything in your life. So it's.
Carol Chalk and then Michael.
So a good segue. So that said, I'm looking at the listing of the 2014 compared to the 2015 recommended, and you were among our, unlike our departments, you were fortunate to be able to have a little bit of an increase because of the sorts of funds that we have. But the ones that the committee seemed to have, so most of them go up. There's four that stay flat, one of which says it's just a placeholder, which is better housing. But of the four that are staying flat are what we think of as fairly basic, among the most basic of services. So housing, food, in the food distribution network, legal is staying flat, the legal services, and friendship, the friendship center. And the others, you know, were recommended to go up some. Can you tell us something about that and the choices to not start from some kind of base raise?
two of them, starting from the top. Better Housing is most people know, or is in conversation right now. So they just ask about how they're going to deliver their services in the future. So they just ask for flat funding because they actually aren't quite sure where they're going in the next year. The Rescue Mission, and I should remind people, we start this process in March in order to have it done and ready to give to Joe in July. So the Rescue Mission had just taken over from the American Red Cross in March. So there wasn't really, frankly, they didn't know they were supposed to fill out these forms. They, you know, we help them do a preliminary, but they couldn't give us the budgets. They couldn't give us anything because they just started that. So, again, they said, could we just go flat this year? So we kept them where they were. Where else? Some Neighborhood Legal Services. Neighborhood Legal Services, by their own admission, had gotten some state funding that they had not anticipated and were, you know, said, you know, we're pretty good. The state funding will help backfill some of the things. Yes. So they said we can just, our funding can stay flat this year. And
Food Pantry was the other one.
Oh, right.
The food pantries, the food pantry is not, it, there's no like staff for the food pantry. The amount of money that we go, that you give to the food pantries goes to the Food Bank of the Southern Tier, and they set up credit lines for all the different food pantries. So there is almost no one to request an increase. So what we've, which is why the review committee asked for $5,000 in addition. They just, they tell us, you know, that there's an increase in people they see, but they don't have any staff to write these applications. We do get one from Lowe's and Fish's, which is part of that network.
They say every year, they say that they're happy to get more funding and they will spend it. They'll use it. It gets divided to, I think it's about 16 pantries now and two other eating things. Community
congregate meals.
But so they're happy to have anything they get, they'll use. And if they don't get it, they say that's okay too. They'll find it. They find it other ways. But it's an odd number.
Or their shelves go.
You could
or empty.
Give them more than that, and they'd find it. They can give, but they're very happy that, unlike a lot of counties, that they're very happy.
The Loaves and Fishes have staff, but all this money goes for food. It goes for lines of credit with the Food Bank of Southern Tier, where they get food for like 20 cents. I'm much cheaper than they could buy it. So,
can I ask another one?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So, sometimes, or has your board or staff had discussions about, let me ask this a different way. I'm thinking through transitions. These organizations that are sometimes in transition, you mentioned a couple, sometimes have one-time needs to help with the transition.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever think about reserving anything, or would you have any way of helping them, if one organization or more, as I know, we have people in town trying to encourage organizations to consider consolidating and how they might come to some efficiencies together. Do you have any way of helping, or do you recommend any way?
Well, I'll tell you, last year you approved a pot of money that we could use this year to help agencies that were having, you know, Red Cross having some transition that we just didn't know where they were going to be throughout the year. And having access to that kind of money so that we can, when things come up, we can help people with that said. That's really helpful. We have not used it at all. I mean, not used at all, but, we don't just say, wow, we've got this money, now we can go spend it. But being able to get to it and help people. We thought there was going to have to be more repairs to the shelter. But because it was right in the transition, we weren't quite sure what they were. And there were a couple of other things that came up last year. But, yeah. that was a really helpful thing to do, and we appreciate the fact that you trusted us enough that we would use it when we needed it and not when we didn't.
So would you be able to do it in 2015?
Sure. Okay. I promise I'll only use it if I need it.
I have Mike Lane and the Leslin.
Don't want to beat the food thing to death, but I think it's in the news a lot right now. And we're hearing that locally, even though our economy is doing a little better, there seems to be an increase in the demand for help for food security. And I wondered if you're hearing from the agencies about that and have any idea what's driving it. Is it the price of food going up? I know they say inflation isn't going up, but the price of food is going up. Is it larger families? Is it just people not being able to work full-time jobs? I wonder what you're hearing, if anything.
Right, and I think it's a combination. And when anything else goes up, you know, foods, you hate to say that food's the one that is fungible, but you know, if your electric goes up or your heat goes up or your rent goes up, in order to keep that housing, you'll then go to the food bank to try to get some food to cover those the cost, because you have to pull that money from somewhere. I think people are, you know, they're stitching together a bunch of part-time jobs. Gas price goes up just trying to get to your jobs. So I think that's the kind of just little things that, I mean, even if you get food stamps, you don't get a lot. And I haven't heard that it's, you know, bigger families. I think it's just, you know, that's where the tipping point is around food. You try to, you know, buy less or make it stretch more or find other ways of getting food so you can use those funds for something else.
Thanks. And if I could just say on the affordable housing things, and whether or not we ought to have, you know, keep some housing for locals, some of the things that we've talked about over the years, hasn't it been that we're trying to encourage more people to live locally that have to commute now to find affordable housing? So it kind of goes both ways.
Local.
Well, yeah, and it's, I mean, commuting is not energy efficient. I mean, you're so... Yeah. But it's hard when you're living in other counties used to much lower rent to be. Mm-hmm. Just as an example, the shelter is run now by the Rescue Mission from Syracuse. And the last time we checked, the gentleman who is the manager here was still commuting every day from Syracuse because he couldn't find housing here he could afford. So he was driving every day.
Leslin.
This is a Joe question. I am trying to understand where would I see the 1% increase reflected?
It should be in their target. Through the agency. Let me see if I can...
I thought that was the basic subsistence page.
No, it was the bottom line contribution. And it should jump off the page, but it's not jumping off of my page.
Yeah, mine either. I don't know what happened to it.
Kevin, you want to jump in?
These are a little not counterintuitive, but not obvious, because what we increase is the net local, and then the revenue in these cases is often something that's moving with our best effort to project the sales tax revenue. And so the top line...
What am I looking at, Kevin? Tell me. What page am I looking at?
I thought you had said basic subsistence.
Yeah, I'm there. I was just wondering if that's where I should be looking to find it.
So it occurs in the when you have the 2014 on page 5, section 5, page 27. Between the 2014 adopted budget, which doesn't show up here, there's sometimes some movement, probably not in this one, but then you get to the 2014 modified.
Right.
So it's not, because it's not the adopted, and we work from the adopted. We take the 2014 adopted, take out their any one-time money they got in 2014 to back it down to a base. Mm-hmm. And then that base is what got the 0.98% increase.
Can I just interrupt?
Please.
That's it. So it's the one-time. So as you and I are both looking at 2014, we're seeing a number, and I'm looking at page 26, which is the consolidated, all the agencies bundled together. So I think you and I were probably looking at a number that's similar, where it went from 679 in 2014 down to 656 as a starting point. And that's why I was scratching my head, too. As soon as Kevin talked about the one time, I think in 2014 there was a one-time item that we do take out. It's one time. So when we calculate targets and growth above target, we take that out. And I believe that in that 679 from 2014 is the 25,000 or so that we gave to the Human Services Coalition for that one-time program that Kathy just talked about. So after you clean out the one-times from 2014, that's really your starting point, and you don't see it on this page. We don't call that out of there. And if you'd like to see the arithmetic, we can do that afterward. We can show you where we started from and how it is up by 1%. The target should be 1% over the 2014 amount.
Over the 2014
ongoing target.
Ongoing target.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you, Kathy. Move on to the coalition of Tompkins County.
Yes.
Chapter 5, page 18, two OTRs, 29 and 30.
We, of course, want everybody to notice that this is our 40th anniversary. We were incorporated in 1974. We're very excited. Also, I wanted to mention that one of the things we do is we use a lot of Cornell and IC interns to help spread out what we do. And they do things like this, like make our presentations pretty. I'm just pausing here. Before I go on to our over targets, I just want to share a couple highlights. Because everybody so generously helped fund the workshop series, I just wanted to report to you that this past year we trained about 651 people from 220 unique organizations, including 16 county departments. One of the things we do, and I think we do well, is kind of logistics for things like that. So we have an agreement now with the Diversity Consortium. They will pick the topics and the presenters, and we will run their trainings, all logistics for our trainings, because we have a system set up to do that. We like to think that we're responsive. They're responsive to the needs of the nonprofit community, and we are just about to launch a middle managers training series, a five-part series, in response to people saying that there isn't a lot of training out there for those people in the middle management positions. And this past year, also in response to a need that we saw, we started two new peer education groups, and one for finance officers and one for chief executives. Finance officers, we felt, were a group that there's a lot going on around nonprofit finances, and this gives them an ability to get together. They set up their own rules. They make their own bylaws. They collect their own dues, of course, which I thought was really cool, because the first thing they'd said was they had to collect dues, being finance people. And we do kind of the staffing, remind them, get together, make all the arrangements, and set up trainings for them so that they can stay up to date on changes. And then they also share information among each other. So I think it's a real good support for that group. And we have just started one for chief executives, so they can help support each other also. Okay. Two on one responded to 12,500 requests for services. Requests are really varied. Certainly tax preparation or tax prep season, healthcare, housing, and requests for community services and transportation are some of the biggest requests that come through 211. And looking at the numbers for this year, we're on track to pretty much those same numbers for 2014. So we screened 2,632 individuals so the VITA program, which only has like a part-time staff person, they were able to do 1,800 tax returns, which resulted in $3.8 million in refunds for people. Again, the fact that 211 is there and can do all the screening scheduling allows this program to do all it does with minimal staff. Also, of course, with all the Affordable Care Act, there was a lot of activity around health-related inquiries, so I'm responded to 3,816. Also, 1,000 responses, and I apologize. My comma should be after the one and not after the scheduling. For medical transportation, and I just wanted to put in that the 211 volunteers received an award for excellence from the Legacy Foundation this year for all the good they do in the community. Couple more highlights. We have three full-trained navigators for the Affordable Care Act, and last year we helped 350 people find insurance through the marketplace. We are going to put on an additional navigator this year. I even wrote down, so the enrollment period for this year, for those who want to know, is November 15th through February 15th. So we will have four navigators in our office. They're not all in the office. A lot of them are out in the community, all over the community, helping people enroll. And we were able to leverage and bring money over $500,000 in state and regional funding, which supports 6.5 FTEs. A lot of that was for our health initiatives, and through those we worked with 1,200 employees in 13 different work sites. 90 people in went through the diabetes management classes, and 2,200 through the falls prevention collaborative. Also, in this money, and this doesn't even count the like $250,000 we bring in a year for continuum of care, which supports homeless services. And again, that's what we do. We can act as managers for things like the continuum of care, which brings in funding to help other organizations. Our major influences are the funding we get, both state law, is really not enough to cover the true cost of doing business. State grants often are very specific about what they'll fund and what they won't. They want you to fund a full-time person but won't pay for the whole fringe. And as much as we do, and we do appreciate the 1% increase, it doesn't really cover our increased expenses. So so we struggle with funding every year. Probably another of the biggest things is regionalization. Many of our funding opportunities, including most of the Medicaid redesign money that's coming down, is coming down on a regional basis, which means somebody from our office has to travel. The county funding, you know, and there's no state funding for that. So county funding allows and makes sure that Tompkins County is able to have a seat at those tables and all that regional, all those regional discussions. Which is very important, because if you're not there, the funding won't come into the community. State reporting requirements for everybody are becoming more involved and taking more staff time. And we're being asked to partner on a lot more initiatives. Collaboration is, you know, collaborative efforts are what's going on now, which is a great direction to go in. But they are time-consuming, and they do take up more staff time. So... And the Affordable Care Act has really increased our workload this past year. Okay, the requests that were supported. So last year I came and I asked for some money to help support a position that could work on the homeless to help to coordinate homeless services. What you had somebody asked, and I can't remember who, if, and I said this is a consortium of funding. They asked if I had gotten it from anyone else, and I hadn't then. So since that time, I have now gotten funding from the Park Foundation, the United Way. So I've come back to ask for funding here, which Joe did recommend, and I also have funding into the City of Ithaca so that there can be joint funding for this position. Partially funded, and it was recommended, we requested $20,000 because that's, so the, just to keep staffing at the level it is in 2014. That isn't even raises. But that's what happens, the cumulative year after year of increases in grants that aren't really covering the cost. And 10,000 of the 20,000 was recommended. Without the 20,000, staff hours are going to have to be cut, and we are stretched pretty thin now. So there are three positions that we haven't funded in the past year and a half alone that we're trying to cover with other staff. So that hurts. Whoops. And then that's the end of that presentation.
Questions for the director?
Hi. I was curious about why you're going from 3 to 4 healthcare navigators. I would just intuitively, I think the first year would be the biggest workload. And
because the when Gene McFeeters left the chamber, that skill. So we are taking over, I guess. We're doing. We took the chamber's navigator under another employee of the coalition. Now they'll be doing the same type of work they were doing before, but under us instead of the chamber.
So the number of navigators in the county will stay the same, just under you guys.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Anyone else? Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you. Let me take a second to clean up.
Next up, OAR, and their Chapter 5, page 28. They have one OTR that was covered. And that is number 43 on page, chapter 4, page 306. Good evening, Deb.
Good evening. I'll try to make this short and sweet. I know you have many nights like this that are long with the budget at this stage. But so my slides are pretty simple. Is it right click or?
Down arrow.
Down arrow. Okay. You can see that we have an over-target request that is included in the county administrator's budget, and it is to restore a client service worker that we lost in 2010, largely. The next slide will show you that what's really influencing that. I've been talking to you, I think, since 2010 about the caseload at OAR and the work since we lost the third client service worker. But we are seeing increasing numbers of individuals seeking services. It's not just the people in the jail. It's more and more homeless are coming into our offices. We refer them other places, but they're just increasing numbers of people who are aware that OAR is there. Many of them have been clients of ours or without some kind of intervention would be clients of ours. So we don't just turn them away. We try to send them to the proper place. I already touched on the loss of the one full-time client service worker, and it was 2010. It wasn't 2011. I went back and checked. And so the caseloads have just been really unsustainable. And then I think that what Kathy talked about with the Human Service Coalition, with human service agencies in general, we've definitely seen that much more complex case management's required because the demographic is changing. We are dealing with more mentally ill, more profoundly mentally ill, both in the jail and then when they're released back into the community, homeless and substance abusers. And it takes a lot more case management to try to integrate those services, particularly mental health and substance abuse treatment. We're still pretty siloed in this community where clients will go in one door and should be you know, be sent to the other door as well and aren't. And so we do a lot of that kind of triage, trying to pull those services together, and I think that will be increasing in the year ahead. So that's basically what our over-target request was, and it's been supported by the administrator's tentative budget.
Questions for Deb? Mike Klein.
Hi, Deb.
Hi, Mike.
I think you were in the audience and heard the district attorney presentation and talking about the defense counsel arraignments and things. Do you think that will lower the number of people coming into the jail that are candidates for the bail program?
Yes, I do. We're seeing that already. It's only been in effect for a few months, but we have seen a substantial number of people who aren't incarcerated right now that would have been prior to that in April or May, which means that OARs, I won't be coming back to you probably for an additional appropriation for the bail fund. But the bail fund is only one piece of what, it's the most easily quantifiable piece of what OAR saves the county, but it's really only one piece of the work we do. So, yes, I do think it's, from our point of view, it's a positive thing. There are fewer people in jail because they have an attorney present at first appearance.
So if I could just take it the next step, with that kind of reduction, do we still need a full-time additional client service worker?
Yeah, I think because of the issue of the more complex case management and that we have diverted a lot of our resources since the cut in 2010 to maintain the numbers of bails we did because we know that that's the most cost-saving issue for the county, but we haven't done as much of the complex case management that really needs to be done to try to reduce their returning to jail over and over again. That 58,000 that the sheriff, the averted board out costs that is being transferred, you know, used or explained to fund this OTR, we saved the sheriff's department that money in one bail we did a year ago, so it wouldn't be in this year's budget, just by going to Rochester and bailing out a pregnant woman who had to be under a guard. So that it's really, it doesn't take much to fund the $50,000 that we've requested as far as bails. So, Mike, you know, there are going to be fewer bails, but that's not the only work we do, and we are seeing, we do the assigned counsel intakes for the assigned counsel office. We do the DSS applications. When people get out of jail, they'll have services waiting for them. We do the Social Security applications more and more, and we're trying to get people onto Social Security who appropriately belong on the disability rolls because that's less county expenditure if they're on federal disability.
Thank you.
Brian.
Thanks. And actually, Mike covered the first part that I was going to ask. I mean, logic would tell you that those are going to be down. But also, this was either the top or certainly one of the top recommendations that came from the ATI task force. Is that correct?
Yes,
was it is. Was it the top?
It was the top because I think it was the simplest, the most immediate need that could be addressed. I'm not sure it's because it's necessarily the most important, but it was the clearest need that can be most quickly addressed.
Okay. And we'll point out that did not only come from you, but from all the folks in ATI, not just the task force, but yeah, within ATI. So we're talking probation, mental health, on and on. And, okay.
Thanks.
I guess our only issue now is going to be whether we accept or endorse this OTR request. I don't know. It's probably going to take a while to figure that one out. But. Thank you.
Please don't say that. Carol.
Mike, this
and
is just,
Peter.
This isn't a question for Deb. I just, if it's for Joe or Kevin, can we get a listing with those same categories? All, you know, in a few pages.
we got this one this year, but it doesn't do it in the same format. And I think in some other years we've gotten the listing of all the, you know, in order, all the OTR numbers with those categories. Is that, or do we have it already?
These are just alphabetical instead of.
Yeah, we can duplicate that for me.
Great, thank you.
Peterstein.
With all the, there's a lot of talk going on now with regard to the jail, with building the extra cells and various new ATI programs that we'll be doing, including this one and others. And I think it might be interesting now to really start a continuing database for us to look at, namely, forgetting the details, just the overall number of how many people are there incarcerated in our jail or boarding out, you know, not distinguishing between those two things as a function of time. You know, maybe starting back 6 months ago and just keeping something going so that we can actually look and see whether we have reduced the amount of people who are incarcerated, no matter where they're incarcerated. Just a suggestion.
Anyone else for Deb? Thank you, Deb.
Thank you.
Next up is Health Department, no OTR request. It is Chapter 4, page 133.
Would help them.
Somebody walked by the sensor.
Yeah.
I did not respond quickly enough to your question. Was there anything else for Deb? So I will ask now, and it could be supplied by staff probably, for the staffing for OAR for the last dozen years, not just the last few years. Thank you.
You want the staffing history at OAR?
All right. Good evening, everyone. Frank Krupa, the Public Health Director. Have with me Brenda Grinnell-Crosby, who's our Public Health Administrator. We'll go ahead and get started with the Health Department's budget for 2015. First slide up, probably the most interesting slide of this particular one that you've seen tonight because of the dramatic changes. And what's reflected there is the difference in the way that we pay for early intervention services now that the state has taken over the fiscal administration. So it used to be we paid 100% up front, and then we chased after the different payers, private insurance, Medicaid, and also got our reimbursement from the state. That's no longer the process. Now the providers have to seek from private insurance and Medicaid first, and then we pay into escrow both our portion and the state's portion, and then the state reimburses us theirs at a later date. So what this reflects is that we are now just paying out of our budget the state's portion and our portion, no longer the private insurance and the Medicaid. So it's a neutral change, but it's a large one. And that's why you see that significant difference there. We just this year made the change to recognize that that change in the process. Our net local is down nearly to the 1% that we were required. Our major influences, when you guys ask us to do maintenance of effort, what becomes a major influence for us are our mandates and the state. So this year, our mandates with early intervention and pre-K are, we spent a lot of time working through those to try to get the numbers to a place where we were both comfortable but also reflected the realities of what we've experienced over the past several years. This is now my fourth budget, and over those 4 years, we've tried to not only account for the increasing costs of the program, but also begin to look and put pencil to paper and really sharpen the focus of what we request from you all as our mandate accounts. And so there's been a convergence in both directions of costs increasing and us reducing our requests of the county. And this year we've kind of hit the point. So after 4 years of working through that, we feel like the cost going up and us tightening down have us to the point where we really sweated out what we needed to ask for this year. So that had a significant impact in how we looked at the overall budget. But we feel like after doing all of that, we're still maintaining essentially a flat request from the previous year, but there is a lot of mechanisms going on behind the scenes just to make you all aware that there are things changing in both directions, and we wanted to make sure that was clear to you guys. And also, on the flip side of our financial sheet of state aid, as you're probably aware, we get reimbursement for our state aid eligible programming that we provide. They give us an initial upfront amount, dollar for dollar, and once that's exceeded, we get 36 cents on the dollar. What's ever changing is what they consider eligible and how they do the math and all the different administrative things that they do to address their budget shortfalls while still giving us state aid. So Brenda every year does her magic on those formulas, and we give it our best go based on the information we have at hand. That obviously affects where we stand as a budget when we're trying to maintain our efforts. Our full-time equivalents have gone down 1.2. 0.2 is a reorganization in WIC. And the one is because we were unsuccessful in maintaining or renewing our tobacco grant. That grant, while we no longer have it here in Tompkins, we have been able to subcontract for half of an FTE with Cortland, who was a successful applicant for our catchment area. So we do still have the program within the county, but it is one less FTE. So those are our changes there. We have no OTRs. We tried very hard to take the charge given by Joe and give you a budget of maintenance of effort. A couple things I wanted to just bring to your attention, specifically related to the budget and some financial things that you might hear from us in 2015. Certainly, early intervention and pre-K, the mandate budgets are always something that are a challenge to one, understand fully when the state is going to process changes in rates that we have to pay, when they're going to pay us, how much they're going to pay us, and those kind of things. And certainly there's always that fear of the family that maybe has twins or triplets that all have needs within the program, and that can dramatically alter the cost that we expect for the program. So we're always monitoring that, and as I said at the beginning, we've tightened things down to where we're really comfortable as far as what we think we're going to need, but more so than probably years in the past, the potential for something large like that would certainly make an impact on our budget. I have electronic health records on here, and I'm using that in a very generic sense. There's a lot of projects going on. We, as some of you may be aware, when we closed the home care agency, one of the issues we were dealing with was our electronic system we used was designed for home care, and we kind of crammed all the public health stuff into it because it was a much smaller portion of that programming. Well, since we're not doing that anymore, it really doesn't make sense to pay the cost of that home care system. So we've been evaluating different products to try to find a public health-based system. And in doing that, we've been communicating with mental health as they're going through a similar process. And so we're trying very hard to look at our two sets of needs together to see if there's a way to find a singular solution that would work for all of us. One hope is that that would allow for interoperability in the future as mental health and physical and public health start to become more integrated. And two, ITS would be very happy with us to only have a singular system. So we like to keep them happy. And in doing all of this, our early intervention program also did a SmartWorks program. Our SmartWorks project, this past year, and it might be surprising to know, but the largest, most expensive program we have at the health department is mainly doing all of their work on paper. And it is a tremendous burden for them to get through and make sure that they have all the documentation that they're required to have and still be able to provide the services. So coming out of that project, obviously, was the need for us to look at, is there an opportunity for us to digitize their processes as well? And as we've been looking at these solutions for our community health services, the opportunity may exist to roll early intervention and pre-K into that same solution. So we're really excited that as a county, we're strategically looking at this potential opportunity going forward where mental health and public health might be able to work together to find a single solution to deal with those issues. And the last one, you heard Kathy mention about regional involvement as well. At the same time that the state is finding ways to take away our state aid, they are also finding ways to provide regional grant opportunities for health initiatives. So we are spending a lot of time keeping up with the many opportunities that are out there and making sure, as Kathy said, that we're in the room and able to present the needs of Tompkins County and make sure that as the resources roll out, that we get our share and are able to make sure our community gets what they need. So there's a lot of that going on, and there is, thankfully, some money behind it. So it's just a matter of understanding the new system and figuring out how that will ultimately make its way into our community so we can provide services. And that is all I have. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Frank? I have Mike and Peter.
My question's quick. I know when the state was taking over the payment of the providers, they were having a lot of trouble getting paid. I didn't know if that had smoothed down.
It smoothed out a good bit. There are still challenges, and one of the biggest challenges is we lost a lot of providers in that changeover. Folks that just wrung their hands of it and said, I can't live this way. I need to go find another way to get my bills paid. And so we are fortunate here where in some counties there are not enough providers to provide all of the service. We struggle to find the providers in that it used to be we picked up a call and the first one we talked to, we'd be able to connect them and get it going. Our nurses are now spending a lot more time having to try to track down providers to be able to provide the services. And so that puts a burden on them. And it also pulls them away from the services that they should be providing as well, you know, as they're doing those administrative tasks. So it's beginning to work from a fiscal standpoint. The state is making progress. I try to be optimistic about all of this. I think if the staff were here, they would tell you it's a complete disaster. And I don't think I'd argue with them. But the end result, hopefully, will turn into something that is a savings for the taxpayers and also still be able to provide the service to the children. But we are still dealing with that issue.
Peter Stein.
Just for my own information, when Frank was here, I used to say I'm confused, and Frank laughed at me. Anyway, Frank isn't here anymore, but I'm still confused. So that first line there, early intervention and pre-K. I read a whole lot in the newspapers about pre-K, the fight between the mayor of New York City and the governor about pre-K and who was going to do what. Is that the same pre-K that you're talking about?
No, that's pre-K services, educational services. We're talking about therapy services for children with delays, developmental disabilities and delays. So we're talking about occupational therapy, speech therapy.
So this is not massive pre-K for everybody you're talking about?
No, these are for children that qualify based on their medical needs.
Okay. And early intervention, I remember, I think I'm not wrong, when hearing from DSS the same sort of thing about foster care intervention in young people. So do they do the same thing as you do, or in what way are they connected or disconnected, or I don't know?
Well, I think that they're certainly connected, but we provide different types of service. We are focused on the developmental delays and providing those medical services through therapy. We work very closely with social services. Their grant, that large grant that they recently received, our nursing staff is actually going to become a coach for one of the programs within that grant, which is a home-based service. So when the children make their way into the system, there's a requirement that they be referred to our early intervention program. And actually, when the reviewers were here for that grant, one of their comments was that they were surprised that we were actually meeting that requirement, because most places don't. So we have a very close connection where those children that go into the system get referred over to our programming to be evaluated to see if they are in need of our services at the department.
That's nice to hear. Thank you very much.
Anyone else for Frank? I saw Mike and then Dooley. Okay, Mike. Dooley, you were ahead of Mike.
Are we ready for a pandemic? We're hearing about, we remember H1N or whatever it was, and we hear about Ebola and things. Are we ready if something like that were to happen?
Short answer is yes. The longer answer is there's always work to be done. I was actually on the radio, I think it was earlier this week, talking about our communicable disease program. And it's important for everyone to understand that communicable disease is something we deal with every day. It's not Ebola. It's not the enterovirus or the things that the news likes to pick up on. But we deal with tuberculosis. We deal with sexually transmitted diseases, measles, all kinds of different communicable disease. So we have a system in place that has the medical providers understanding that they need to notify us if they see suspect cases of these types of diseases. They were mandated to report them to us. And then we have staff that does investigations into whether we need to contact people that they may have been communicate with people that may have been contacts for those cases and provide treatment or education or whatever might need to happen. So that system is in place, and we do that well, and it's part of the reason that we don't see these type of widespread disease issues that you might see in a place like West Africa that doesn't have that infrastructure. So we have that in place. Now, if you're talking about something where large numbers of the population might be dying rather rapidly, then that becomes a resource issue. You know, we have the abilities to track it and understand and know it's there. It begins the process then, is it a local issue where it's just in Tompkins County? Is it a regional issue, state, national issue? And that all plays into the resources that can be called upon. But we have mechanisms in place where if we don't have the resources here in the county, we call the state. If they can't meet those resource needs, they call the federal government, and we all work together to try to address whatever we might need to. So the short answer is yes, there's a system in place, but the longer answer is we always could do more, and we could always use more resources.
One other question on things like flu shots. With more pharmacies, for example, giving these flu shots to people, do we have a way of tracking how we're doing in Tompkins County, for example, as far as getting our population vaccinated?
The state tracks those, so there are some general reporting requirements, but we're never going to know, you know, an exact number. Each year the state puts out a report that talks about vaccination rates, because there are a myriad of places, the pharmacies, grocery stores, your doctor, public health facilities, employers. Our Tompkins County is actually having our prescription drug company, PROAC, provide flu shots for our employees this year. So there's a lot of places, not all of them report accurately, but we do have a general sense of kind of what the percentage is. But for Tompkins County, it's always hard to really track down, because are we talking about people that work here, live here, just come through? Is it the student population? They could get their flu shot in another country and then come here. Are they, you know, part of what we would count in those numbers? So that's a very long answer to what you asked, but honestly, we just try to look at what the general vaccination rates are, get communication out about how important it is to do. If we were way below, say, the regional average or the state average, certainly we would address that, but we are not. We tend to trend right where we should be as far as the central New York and even New York as a whole.
Thank you.
Dooley and then Carol.
Thank you. I'm looking at Appendix B on page 7. These are health department contracts, and there are many, many of them described as maintenance in lieu of rent, and I wondered what that is.
That one's payment to the county for our facility.
For the Brown Road facility.
Yes.
And they all seem flat, except for one, which isn't flat. And why are they all flat?
We don't have a projected increase in our rent on that facility. I have to look to see which one is not flat. It's probably a reallocation of space to another program.
I was wondering if, and maybe Joe is the right person to ask, is the maintenance done by facilities?
Yes, it is.
And don't their costs go up every year?
They do.
So had we made a policy decision to keep this flat?
No, but I don't think the contracts necessarily. I don't know if these overlap directly into your line items or not, Brenda, whether there's any provision for growth here. I will tell you that for 2015, I mean, generally salaries and fringe rates go up. For 2015, there are no negotiated wage increases. And as we talked about earlier tonight, fringe benefits, if anything, are down a tick. So you would expect those to be flat between the 2014 budget and the 2015 budget.
Well, there's one that was just introduced, I guess, last year. And I was curious about what that would have been. That's on page B7.
$1,200. Which one is it?
They all have the same name.
Right. What's the number? What's the dollar?
That one was our Healthy Neighborhoods program, and when that program was re-awarded to us this year for April 1st, there was a reorganization of staffing. So they have less staffing, less space, so the county has probably absorbed that space.
Although the cost has gone up a little bit. Well, it's small amount.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. They probably shifted which office they were in. Okay. They probably got a larger office than what they had before. It's done office by office.
I see. Well, so that's a subject that I think we should talk about sometime, but not here.
Okay.
Facilities has its problems, too. And then I had a question about page 134, 136, where travel and training is going down. Is that just a voluntary cut?
136, you said?
I think that's the page it was on.
That's great. She's not going to Atlanta.
Included in administration is our preparedness travel dollars, and one of the big expenses is an annual conference in Atlanta that we were not expecting to travel to that we had planned for previously. So that accounts for that difference, I believe.
So that could come back next year, I mean the year after.
Yes, but it's grant funded, so it would be net neutral to the county.
Okay, thank you. I have a question on page 154. This is family health, I guess. Is that? No. Healthy Neighborhoods Grant, which deals with air pollution. And it reminded me of the inability of the county health department to provide any kind of direct relief for people in the city who were suffering from particulate smoke. And I wondered if this grant could have been used, some of it, for that.
The grant is specific to home visiting and providing education and supplies for
health and safety. So, for example, our folks will go to a particular neighborhood based on where the grant has allowed them to go. And I think in this most recent one, it covers most of the county now. But they would be able to go to someone's home and sit with the residents and talk about their home, how they could make it more safe, and also provide them with a long litany of supplies to do that, everything from fire extinguishers and CO meters, CO alarms, to things like mattress covers and pillowcase covers, to cleaning supplies, anything that might be necessary for that individual homeowner. It is a voluntary program. Folks would have to invite us in. Certainly, if those folks that were affected by the wood smoke were interested in a healthy neighborhoods visit, we would coordinate that. But I don't think that what we provide would be able to address the issue that they're facing from the wood smoke coming from a neighbor's chimney. For example, we wouldn't be able to airtight their house or move their HVAC system if that was a potential solution or things like that. It's more supplies around basic health and safety within the home.
Okay. I had a question on another page. I guess it's page 156, occupational health and safety.
That is our health and safety officer for the county, Frank Croteau. He works out of my office, but he's responsible for the health and safety of all 700 county employees.
I'm interested in the description that says he provides quarterly computerized generated safety audits of all departments. What does that refer to?
Frank, along with the safety officers for each building within the county, some buildings have share a safety officer. They do quarterly inspections on the high-risk facilities. I believe we do semi-annual on the low-risk facilities. But essentially, they walk through and check for things like, are the fire stairwells clear? Do we have torn and frayed carpet that might be a trip hazard? Do we have improperly used power strips? Anything that might be a health or safety issue for our employees. And then when you get into, like, facilities or highway, he does go out to the sites in some instances and check to make sure folks have their vests and their hard hats and the flaggers are where they're supposed to be, those kind of things. So it depends on the facility, but he does those quarterly. He does that. There is an electronic reporting system that once that inspection is done, that's shared with the department head as well as facilities for any remediation that might be necessary.
So this is one person, and is the budget that's reflected, the expenditures on that page, is that, what is that?
That's for Frank's salary, fringe, and small supply line.
And so it's going down.
The fringe rate went down this year, so it's probably, I can look, but it's probably in fringe.
Okay.
He also cut some funds for books and publications because they bought a subscription service for his training videos. And that's paid for already. But his savings is primarily in his fringes, and that's due to the fringe rate.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Carol.
My questions are about environmental health.
Mm-hmm.
As part of your answer, I would love to hear just something about the status of our environmental health or what issues you see coming up. I noticed that if you compare environmental health budget from 2014 to the proposed, it's only goes down a little bit. But if you look back to 2012 and 2013, the state aid portion, I'm on page 4-148, the state aid portion went down by not quite $200,000. Is that reflected in our programs? What are we not able to do there that we used to do?
Well, one piece of it is we pulled the Healthy Neighborhoods Program grant out into its own module now. So that's one of the changes. Do you want to talk to the state aid, Brenda?
Actually, that is a, it's a state grant. So it, the change really is pulling Healthy Neighborhoods into its own functional unit called 4018 would be the number.
Okay. And then one issue that I've, in addition to the particulate issues, which I think Cooperative Extension really tried to come in and help with, not with great success, but perhaps Ken could talk about that. But an issue that I'm hearing a lot about this year happens to be an increase in rats in College Town and Bryant Park, maybe other parts of the city. Where do you send people, and is anything built into the budget to help address that? Do you see an increase, and if so, is anything built into the budget to start to try to address it?
No, there's nothing built into the budget. If folks have a rat situation that is being caused by waste being piled up and not disposed of appropriately, unmaintained yards with high grass that could be harboring rodents, we can certainly investigate and try to address those issues. Oftentimes there's crossover between us and code enforcement in those issues because the problem stems from inside a home. So say you have someone that has an unsanitary condition inside a private residence that's causing rats, that's a little more complicated because we don't really have the authority to just go into someone's home and address those issues. So rodents are, it's a difficult issue and it's hard to give you a black and white answer. We tend to take those calls and based on the particulars of each individual case, try to work with whoever we think the appropriate agency is, if it's not us, to get folks connected. But I can tell you that in a lot of instances, there's not a simple solution to dealing with the issue.
Okay. And then to what do you see upcoming issues in environmental health that you're not necessarily going to be able to meet in this budget?
Wow. Well, that's a big question.
Where do you see the biggest need there?
Well, I think one of the challenges that we're going through, and I think you've heard in other presentations, is changeover in staff. So we've had two of our three senior sanitarians retire, and a third one's planning in the next 6 months. So we've had some succession planning and things that we had to address. So we have new folks coming in that are looking at things with fresh eyes, and we're in the process of, you know, evaluating where we need to go with our programming. I'll be honest with you, the regulatory requirements that we have to do take up the majority of our time, and most of the other emerging issues are just absorbed as they come up. You know, I think fracking is the big one in the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years that ate up a lot of time for staff, but it's hard to plan for. Would I love to have another EH person just sitting around waiting for those emerging things to happen? If you guys want to talk about that, I'd be happy to give you a number. But when we're talking maintenance of effort, our focus is mainly on doing the regulatory requirements and then figuring out how we absorb the emerging issues.
Well, if fracking is less of your time now, it's going to be interesting to see if you're back here right after the gubernatorial election.
Anyone else? Thank you very much, Frank. Excellent.
Thank you.
Cooperative Extension, Ken Schlatter. He'd been here three straight nights, and finally he's getting on. It's chapter 4, 5, page 4. He has OTR 6 and 7 both put in the county administrator's budget.
You know, Jim, it is 7:40. I mean, if you want to call it a day.
Now, actually, this one was supposed to start at 7:35, so we're only 5 minutes late. And Ken has done this so many times, he can do it in 5 less minutes.
And just cut me off.
Go ahead.
Well, thanks first for inviting me here and for the opportunity to talk. Thanks also very much for the support. Our budget for 2015 is from the county is $691,000. This is on a budget for the year. We're looking at a budget next year of about $5.5 million. I just thought it would be interesting to go back and see when the county, when Cooperative Extension first sort of broke $1 million in its budget. Clearly, I don't have enough to do. But and it was about 25 years ago, 1991 or 1990, I can't remember. And at the time, the county appropriation was $588,000, and that was the year that the association broke $1 million for the first time. Major influences for us. I grade these two big sort of background influences. We have upcoming retirements of a couple of senior program staff and space. Some of you may recall that I was here earlier this year. We're still looking at that. It still has some influence on what we do. But the three that really have, that are related to this budget are this regionalization that people have been talking about before. In our case, it's a shared business network that we've been working on for the past 4 years. There's quite a bit to report on that. I won't bore you with most of it. But I will say, though, that it does actually, some of the things that we've been working on with this really promise to have promise for providing support to other nonprofits in this county. These growing economic sectors, both in food and energy, the amount of growth in both is getting greater every year. I think we're now seeing a lot more interest on the part of groups like TCAT, for example, in food and in agriculture. I think it's an indication of how much these things are becoming relevant to the economic viability and vitality of this county. And then the rapidly developing emphasis on systems approaches to youth development. There's quite a bit of talk and efforts recently around collective impact, but really the development of systems approaches to youth development has been going on for quite some time. The County Youth Services has been heavily involved in it from the very beginning. Before I go to some of the other, I thought it would be useful to just touch briefly on the OTRs that you provided to us last year. There were two one-time OTRs provided last year. One was for the shared business network. We had we were anticipating significant costs. As it turned out, we ended up, we put a lot of effort into this. We have the lowest cost shared business network in the state of the 10 networks. And in our region, five of the eight associations have actually reported a net gain. Actually, it's cost them less. We had aimed for cost neutrality. Five have actually been able, because of cuts in costs, things that through efficiencies we've developed that have mainly come out of this association, they've been able to report net gains. In some cases, it's because they were able to avoid losses that they would have had otherwise through, we might say, poor management. We did not receive a net gain. But we did see significantly less losses, less costs than we'd expected relative to what we have to, what we thought we'd get out of it. So it's been a tremendous amount of work. I don't wish it to anybody. I'm sorry for all these folks who have been talking about regionalization tonight. I hope they never have to get involved in it. But there are some benefits to it, and I'd be happy to share those sometime. The other one was for website development, and it was primarily for this sort of staff development, staff management website, which has focused on, and we've done a number of different things, but it's for us this year, it's actually had an impact on staff orientation and training in the region. We've been piloting this mostly with some of the smaller associations in the region, and after they spend their time on it, then we'll bring it into our association. No, but it's been easier to actually pilot it with smaller associations than with ours. So we've focused mainly on those. Total FTEs saved on HR compliance and bookkeeping, which were two major ones for us this year, looked to be about a half of an FTE. And I thought it would be useful just to give a screenshot from one of the from the website that we've developed. It's called MyCCE, which is, in this case, it's about orientation. And the reason for showing it is because what it does is it allows us, and it allows somebody who wants to design an orientation to do it really quickly. There's a whole set of documents. There's a whole set of steps that they can take, and they can basically assemble them in any form they want to. So, in our, so you could have somebody doing a before you begin. You can organize this information by the type of stuff they need to do. You can organize it by what department they're in or what association they're in. So you can make it tailored as specifically as you want to. And then, it can also organize and categorize your information by time. So, for example, somebody is, before they begin, they can actually plug into some of the things that they can actually take care of. They might then, we have these tiers where they might, tier one, everybody would do all this. Their day one, here's the stuff that they would actually do on day one. Here's the stuff that they would do on week one. You can set it up for week two, week three. It's all done essentially automatically, and it can all be tailored and designed by the supervisor or by the HR people in the organization. So it's been, it's the people who've been using it love it, and it's really easy to use. So it's been really fun actually to develop this. Other websites that we've used, so the funding that you gave us was primarily for the development of this MyCCE. But because that allowed us then to have a it allowed us to have a full-time web developer. We had other things that we could do then, and I've already shared some of this with you before. But the PEAKS crowdfunding website has been able to do quite a bit of fundraising, has been used by a large number of organizations here in Tompkins County. So here's a sampling of some of the campaigns that have taken place in the past couple of years with this site. Sure.
Is it just for organizations or is it businesses too? Or?
We did use it for Cuba Pure Organics when they had their fire burned down. And that was because of the mission, the local food related portion of the mission. We've also used this, the same set of people been able to then work on several other websites, which have actually been, are now being used by people in the county. So these are all parts of a suite of websites and databases that have the ability to talk to each other, that can be used independently and separately, but complement each other quite well. And so this donor database, which costs less than 20%.
Here's a microphone.
Sorry, I thought I had it on. Okay, sorry. This donor database that costs less than 20% of what a commercial database costs is something that actually talks to that constituent relation management database. And so it allows then any organization that's using these to actually manage the people they're working with, the donors they have, the participants they have, in ways, and tailor messages to them in ways that would be beneficial to those participants and those constituents. We also have been partnering with Finger Lakes Reuse on a step-by-step how to develop a community reuse center website. And that website actually has all sorts of applications. So we're right now working on it for working on developing a commercial building energy efficiency step-by-step process. So commercial building owners could easily tap into this website and basically follow step-by-step what other commercial building owners have done, and then replicate those same things with themselves in their own organization or in their own business, own buildings, excuse me. Okay, so that's it on the OTR piece and the websites that we've had. We'll be back to that at the OTR, the next OTR set. But I thought it would be useful and fun to explore, to really to sort of talk about the some of the work that's been going on with youth development and with food systems and energy in ways, and I wanted to share this with you because it sort of demonstrates, I think, a little bit of the creativity of a tremendous staff that we have, ex-staff as well. This person, the woman on the left here, is Emma Frisch, who some of you may know was on the Food Network recently. She's a former employee of ours. I'd like to say that she got her start with us, but that wouldn't be quite true. But she passed through and did a fantastic job. She's worked now with Gardens for Humanity and a number of other of our staff on a range of things related to food. And I just thought it would be fun to take a look at this. Whoops, I'm going to go back here.
I'm Josh Stolen, the creator of the Seed the Table program, and I'm so excited to have each of you participate in this, the first ever Seed to Table cook-off.
You're going to have 2 minutes to shop from this beautiful spread of fruits and vegetables. 2 minute shop begins now!
We have four teams competing, and the little chefs all nominated their own team leader, and I'm really excited to see what they pull out of the kitchen today.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1!
Everybody. I'm going to talk about veggie time. There was this beautiful fried zucchini.
These actually came out really well.
Yeah, these are really good.
I like that they used the fresh thyme.
Really loved the touch with the calendula flower in the middle and the sprinkled petals. So Sass Tacos, we really loved your dish.
And I'm Josh Stolen.
That's not what we wanted to hear. So stay tuned. You can find out who the winner is. There's actually another of those sessions, the Seed to Table, is coming up starting, I think, this week, in fact. Part of the reason, for bringing it is the creativity that's been on the part of the staff. It's also because food and energy both are just incredibly viable and as I said, vibrant, growing industries and in this county, and they have really strong connections. And youth can actually plug right into that at very early stages and as well as they move into careers. And in our case, as I said, there's a rapidly growing sort of effort towards systematization of youth development in the county. In our case, we're working now with this year we went through the 3,000 youth, regularly exploring many different youth development opportunities and developing deep relationships with adults. So we've been working with lots and lots of youth for a long time, but the key piece is this repeated interaction with adults, exploring things that matter to the kids, and then having a chance to fail, having a chance to succeed. And knowing that when they do fail, that there's somebody there who cares, who's actually going to talk through with them what actually happened and how they can learn from that. We do it in three primary ways, these three ways that are listed right there. But we also, I wanted to connect it to this, to the energy and food, because food is both of those are. And industries I have to go back to my notes because I've just forgotten why I wanted to talk about food and energy.
Can stay on the microphone, okay?
Okay.
Because they are broadcasting, and you're not going to be heard.
They're a major growth area. Two, they basically have lots of entry level jobs, and these are jobs that basically can be for youth. They can also be for people in reentry. And so we've been focusing a lot on developing businesses, supporting businesses in these areas, because they're basically wealth-building engines for low-income communities, and their entryways or pathways to good jobs for youth and for people in reentry. So some of the ways that we've been doing that have been, just this year, we've had 10 micro businesses using these catering kitchens of ours. We have two, and you can see that I don't know if you've had the Ithaca hummus yet. If you haven't, you will be very soon, because they just negotiated a huge contract with Wegmans, and they're actually moving into the Challenge Industries Finger Lakes Fresh Food Hub in Groton. They'll be leaving our site in December and moving into the food hub. The regional infrastructure for wood for bulk wood pellet delivery. This is a partnership with a number of different businesses, expecting to generate a large number of jobs in the region over these next few years. And then we've been doing a lot of work with facilitating the hiring of youth and others entering the workforce. Here's an example of that. All these are examples of things that we've been doing just this year. There have been others in the past that we continue with. This one is something that we started with Tatum, and it's been, for Tatum and for the two apprentices working there, it's been a great experience. We've actually had two other firms here locally, two renewable energy firms, contact us and ask to start this process. So we're actually starting right now with two other firms to do this this apprenticeship program for renewable energy. So our over-target requests this year, both recommended, both one time. One is for partial staffing for the an initiation of a collective impact youth career readiness program. And the other is for the continued development of these websites, in particular the website around staff productivity for 2015.
Questions for Ken? Mike Lyon.
So the ad in the paper reminding people about the 4-H programs, looking for young people that want to come into that. How is our 4-H program doing?
They're doing fantastically, actually. If you're talking about the traditional club program, it's had little growth, but it stayed steady with about 320 kids in the clubs. That's about what it's been for the last 10, 12 years.
And that's both rural and urban clubs, right?
Urban's another 80.
Another 80.
Yeah. In fact, one of the things, you know, last year, there was also an OTR that was funded through County Youth Services for the urban program. And there had been questions about how those numbers were doing and whether they would actually be going up. And Jamila Simon just mentioned to me the other day that in her side alone, there are two sides, I think she said 76 kids have signed up now, which was twice what was there a year and a half ago.
Great.
In that program.
Dan.
Hi, Ken. I have a couple of questions about a couple of different things here. You mentioned in last year's OTR that last year's OTR saved you the equivalent of 0.5 FTEs.
Not us. Last year's OTR. No, I said for the region.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Can you tell me about this commercial and home horticulture program? I see that there's a big increase coming, two FTEs and about $100,000 more. Can you tell me about that?
What page is it?
Sorry, we're on section 5, page 9.
Not off the top, I'd have to go back. I can get back to you with that.
Great, thank you. Can you tell me, same page, community development, about the Peak site. Can you tell me about the expenditures there, $320,000? Is that more than just Peaks, or is that all for Peaks?
Expenditures are $320,000?
Doesn't sound right?
That doesn't sound
right.
Okay.
You can come back to me with these some other time.
That's the entire community development. It isn't just Peaks, that program. So, no, Peaks is a small piece of that. That would also include the natural leaders. That would include much of what is going on in, there's an OCFS grant that Elizabeth Wolf, you probably remember Elizabeth Wolf, is involved with, which is the Groton Families Program. There's a program in Newfield. So it's actually the community development, the entire community development area.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a little about the peaks then. So you're not sure what, is it some small percentage of that?
Peaks, it costs us about $10,000 a year to run.
And on the slide, you talked about the advantage of it being that it costs maybe 20% less than other crowdsource fundraising sites?
No, that 20% is for the donor databases. Donor databases would be where if you're going to do a mail ask or some other ask, you'd have a set of donors in your database where you can do mass mailings. You keep track of the giving that they've done and that sort of a thing. PEAKS can talk with that donor management database, but PEAKS is a crowdfunding website. The donor management database is a donor management thing. It's a database.
Okay. About PEAKS, then, what's different about it than the other crowdsourced, Indiegogo and
the biggest
Kickstarter
thing
and all
is,
that?
Sorry. The biggest is what people have said to us. So, there's no difference in the mechanism. The big difference is in the handholding. Is in the support. Many, in fact, we've seen this repeatedly here. Many nonprofits have relatively little facility. Many people my age, including myself, could really use handholding if it came to crowdfunding, and so that's part of what this is about. It's basically helping people more easily develop campaigns. And sharing information based on what's been learned in previous campaigns with people who are generating new ones.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Carol.
Yeah, my question was just about those two databases. Who did you make them available to, and whether they have to pay for them, or whether you just make them available for use?
The PEAKS website is there's a tiny charge. It works out to a couple percent. We don't recover what it costs us to run it. But as I said, it's useful for us because it allows us actually to run our own campaigns as well. The other question was
the training.
Yeah, the donor database and these others. These are open source databases. They come from a site. If you Google CiviCRM, CIVICRM. It's an open source database that is supported by a huge community across the world, but you have to sort of tailor it to your own your own organization or your own situation, and that requires somebody who's relatively knowledgeable in database development. So we have somebody on staff who will do that at cost. So if it costs us $300 or $500 or $1,000, that's what we charge to do that.
Anyone else? Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you.
I think Julie had one more question.
No, I'll just ask Ken.
I'm sorry? We are here next Tuesday night and next Thursday night. Have a good trip to New York, Joe. The Cornell bus goes 80 miles an hour. It does. I followed it yesterday. Thank you all for coming.